So this is episode 3, and I guess we've been thinking about why don't men take part in research, or why don't men take part in healthcare or kind of seek healthcare. And we've talked a bit about that, kind of internal, external structures. So now we're going to try and talk about what can we say to help researchers better engage men in their projects.
I suppose out of the people around the table here, there's several of us have got groups of men that we're already talking to. So we can speak, I suppose, from first-hand experience as to how we've engaged our groups. And I'm happy to kick that off, obviously. But So my guys are, again, typically white middle-class guys. Those are the people that have joined my organisation. I want to reach a bigger audience than that. But these guys... distraction seems to be a wonderful way of getting guys to just open up. And there was a really good example that I experienced firsthand. So one of my a visit back to my old childhood home at Christmas, I bumped into my old next door neighbour, and he was participating in men in sheds. So retired garage owner, and weirdly enough, the retired policeman was the guy that coordinated it all. And he said to me, look, Jim, who's my old neighbour, which was the mechanic, he had gone in there and he'd had prostate cancer. And he was telling everybody that would listen about his prostate cancer. Now, Jim was the kind of guy that never used to do that. But Jim was also the guy in the men in sheds, because he was a mechanic, that he knew where all the machines worked. So not only was he going to show Bob and Derek and Phil how these machines worked, whilst he was demonstrating to them, the distraction of using that machine enabled him to talk about these other conversations. And he was then saying, yeah, well, you know, I think it's really important you go to the doctors and get your prostate checked, because I went a bit late and then I've got the cancer, and so on and so forth. So that distraction technique, Derek, you talked earlier on about sitting around a fire or making pizzas as well.
Yeah, we kind of call it the magician's trick, because the magic happens not quite where you're expecting it to happen. So you're distracted by a sleight of hand or a pizza that smells nice, and a fire that looks good, or you know, you're camping out in the woods or whatever you're doing. You can then open a conversation which is much more real and more authentic because of that distraction. And I think, you know, if you're to engage men in research and design of services, it has to be done in a way which is in that way accessible. Otherwise, you'll just get the same stuff, you know, because, you know, we're lucky enough to have groups which are made up of referrals from social prescribers, self-referrals, people just hear about the groups and come along. So we have kind of a very wide range of individuals that attend, people like me who are disabled and very able, young people, and they all have a what I would describe as one thing in common, other than being a man, is the need to have a connection or a trusted relationship where they can share. Because that seems to be lacking in almost, you know, every aspect of groups of men. We can have conversations, and we can have very lightweight conversations. But when it comes to having something much more real and authentic, they don't happen. Although, you know, I think I mentioned this before, I think that now is the time. I think there is a sea change coming. I think men are now becoming more likely to want to engage. There are groups like ours and Matt's are getting more and more popular. People are reaching out. So I think now's the time to get in early and start coming side by side, researchers with men's groups, researchers with, you know, when you're wanting to find, get in early and become part of it. We're saying that continuum of connectivity, because then you become a trusted member. And just because you're a researcher doesn't mean you're not a man, doesn't mean you don't have worries, doesn't mean you don't have concerns. We all do, and let's all talk about it.
I think your continuum of connectivity was a really helpful phrase that I've been kind of mulling over since you first said it in our meetings, and this idea that you can't just parachute in to do something. You have to, that has to be on the point of a journey of or that continuum of engaging with healthcare or with thinking about yourself and your own kind of physical and mental health needs. And that kind of trust that you need to build up. And I think from a research point of view, that's not something we do that often. So there are one or two communities where we've really invested time and energy over a long period of time. And the one that springs to mind are the memory cafes. But I can't really think of any immediate places, other groups where we have that same kind of level of long-term investment. But actually, that feels like that's exactly what we need. If you're interested in having men taking part in your research, and not just the, you know, the 25% of men like us that are prepared to talk about these things, but the others, then we have to think differently. And that means that kind of long-term engagement within where the places where men go and feel comfortable talking about stuff.
It sounds to me like it's what's required is a more of that anthropological study than that medical study of, you know, going to where the people are instead of expecting them to sort of turn up asking for help. And also about your claim about the, you know, the fact that he had that authority to be able to talk to them about anything that's going on in the garage.
Yeah.
Whether that gave him the space that he could have that vulnerability of also talking about the things that weren't going right. Because everyone was respecting him because he had that knowledge. He had that freedom.
Yeah, he was in I was going to say a position of authority. Not necessarily thought authority, but he was in a really comfortable place.
Respected position.
Respected. Yeah, I like that. That's better. He certainly felt, oh, okay, well, you know, I can help these guys do this because I've done this for 40, 50 years. But at the same time, I've been through something more recently and these guys are all my peers. Maybe I can help them in other ways as well. I think the way that that's set up is totally intentional, but unintentional. So, yeah. You know, it's a lovely space that just brings about those conversations.
But it's why when we first had our first get together for this group was to go for a walk. And I think that was really, you know, we actually had that conversation. Well, not only should we practice what we preach, but actually let's put ourselves in a side-by-side scenario. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that involves experts working alongside non-experts. But there's something about that side-to-side that's really transformational in the way that, you know, we might engage with others and the other men might engage with the stuff that we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, like from a research design and even a healthcare design point of view. Well, maybe it's intentional, maybe it's not. Well, it absolutely needs to be intentional. And I think I have similar experiences up at the allotment. You know, those same sorts of conversations all went out running or walking or cycling. The types of conversations you're able to have just feel more like kind of more meaningful or more in depth. And you can
more connected.
And you can talk about the really hard stuff. And sometimes it's not having to look at someone directly in the eyes and say it.
It's that clinical setting, is it? You know, we sent, again, generalising, men feel a little bit off-put by having to look into another man or another person's eyes and talk about stuff that they're a bit shy about talking about.
About their prostate.
It's difficult. Like you say, it's. I wrote something down and it's, again, we mentioned in the last episode about role models. It's also doing what your mates do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if we can kind of tap into this at an early stage and make it the norm, and our mates are going to the doctors, our mates are getting involved in this stuff, then I'm going to do stuff that my mates do.
Is that a safety in numbers response?
Probably, yeah.
That herd, herding. If I stick with the herd, I'm not going to be
I think that might be an element, but I'm still struck by a story Derek told us about... you know, a person, a man crying at one of, you know, kind of breaking down in tears because actually the stuff that was being talked about was really challenging.
Mm.
And that prompting a much younger lad who turned up to also kind of cry, not really knowing why, but, well, Derek, you better tell us the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's the permission to be vulnerable and the permission to talk about things that are heartfelt, but you can't, you have no other place to do it. And then when the door is opened to that and you can experience others, it gives you permission yourself to then open the door to your sometimes sadness, sometimes joy. You know, we've had examples where someone hadn't spoken to their daughter for 20 years, but through the support of the group reached out and spent the first full day with them. Now, that's just like heartbreakingly wonderful.
Mm.
But he wouldn't have been able to do that unless he had been supported and had permission to be vulnerable and talk about it. And you know, I think, and that's where the research needs to be. And that's where the researchers need to be, is in that space, because when those conversations happen in the gym or in the allotment or side-by-side type venues or in food banks or wherever they're happening, how does it become a funnel of golden thoughts and ideas that then can transcend into something else? How do we create like a library, a bank of this wonderfulness that then can feed researchers?
Yeah. I wonder if it comes down to the sort of the power dynamics of it, where you can actually feel like, you know, that there is almost like that father figure of asking for advice, be it on an, you know, area of expertise. You can open up because you've got that intimacy of, well, you've just explained something to me on a practical level. I like practical stuff. It's manly, you know, it's tangible. It's now let's try something that isn't tangible. Is that, you know, let's talk about something that is intangible, emotional.
Yes.
Yeah, well, but James, you also talk about intimacy there, and we've not really talked about that much, but I think in healthcare and in healthcare research, we expect people to be quite intimate quite quickly on the basis of no relationship other than you're a health person, I must be able to trust you, which generally works out.
Yeah.
But actually what we're saying is that for men, that seems particularly hard, to build that kind of level of trust quickly and then to be able to speak intimately about stuff. Some men find it okay. It would seem like the majority would struggle from what we've heard and what we've read, and the data seems to back that up in terms of health outcomes. So how can health researchers, well, we maybe don't know the answer, how can health researchers help create kind of trust in environments where men are able to kind of feel like they can share some of the most innermost and intimate stuff about what they've experienced? We don't know the answer, but it's definitely not putting a poster on a GP's waiting room wall.
The word that keeps coming up for me, which I think every single one of us has said, is relationships. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's about, you know, I don't think we're going to solve this issue in this podcast. But I feel where we're going is that in an ideal utopian world, we're going to build a long-term relationship between researchers and men and other areas that you want to engage with. That has to be started. When's the best time to plant the tree? Today or 20 years ago? So we need to get that stuff in place.
Yeah. Or so invent that, time travel.
There's the practical man solution.
That's outside the scope of funding. But yeah, I think, you know, so those long-standing relationships, because otherwise I think men are going to struggle to be well represented in the research that takes place.
Yeah.
Which we think, you know, maybe a sort of a not quite fully formed hypothesis is that, well, maybe that then the lack of men taking part in research then shapes how healthcare is designed and delivered, which then might contribute to the situation we're in. So somewhere we need to find a way to break it, which takes us, break that kind of cycle, which I suppose takes us back to the structure. Well, it's easier to put an umbrella up than build a roof. So maybe the kind of changing stuff in research is part of put the umbrella up. which, you know, which is a tool that you can use that we can change a little bit the way that research is delivered and designed to improve the way men want to kind of take part. And that in turn might help change the kind of overall structure of how healthcare is delivered.
I'm wondering to what extent really that men are tricked into participation through the doing the walk or the pizza, practical activities,
and stuff,
that actually they didn't want to come to necessarily share something. They wanted to come and do something practical, and then you've tricked them into actually engaging in something that you want them to do. And which is open up.
I think that's a dark way of looking
at it. We have to ask in our next episode on ethics and morals.
No, it's interesting though, but I think the way that we... I think it's a really good question, because there are ways that you can... we set up one group which was purely as a referral process for people who'd gone to their GPs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was clear that there was something that needed to be unlocked or supported. But that just happened organically and without any kind of prompting or professional kind of counselling or whatever kind of pseudo kind of door opening you want to use. It just happened because suddenly everyone was comfortable. And that's true for the ones that aren't sent through social prescribing. And I'm not sure if Matt, or can't speak for Matt, but I think it goes back to that safe space permissions, talk about anything you like, because a lot of the time we're not just talking about serious stuff, we're talking bollocks.
Just having a laugh.
And having a bloody good laugh, yeah.
And I don't think people are being tricked. I think maybe what it's pointing to is that actually there are many, many men out there that aren't seeking help, that are actually really desperate for a place where they can form friendships and relationships that are based on a bit more than what they might ordinarily be, and that those friendships are deeper, that they kind of, they want to hang out with other people and be able to talk about the stuff that bothers them.
Yeah, we had one guy who hadn't spoken to anyone other than his doctors and nurses for 2 years. He was lived on his own, and that's all that he saw for 2 years.
I mean, again, we could go off on lots of topics, not trying to take away from it, but there is amongst men, generally, typically, lots of caveats, a loneliness epidemic.
We're
not good at doing the social stuff. I read a book recently. It's called Billy No Mates by a journalist, and he just out from the outside in, successful man, successful career, had a girlfriend at 33 years old, said please marry me. She went straight into bridesmaids, maids of honor, all that stuff, and he went best man, and then he didn't really have anybody in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he'd fallen into the trap of, he loves his girlfriend, they would socialize with her friends, and he would make friends with the male friends, but they weren't the guys he grew up with. They weren't the guys that could tell stories about him at his stag do and do a good best man speech. You know,
lots of acquaintances and no friends.
Yeah.
And that's it. And men are falling typically into that. And that's part of the reason I started what I did, just to get guys, give them a space to get talking a bit more, because it might lead to conversations that are really important. I mean, I had a gathering of four blokes around a table to watch the rugby on Saturday. And it was great fun, and there was a few beers involved. And then I walked away with one of them, and we had a lovely conversation, which I know he was desperate to talk to somebody about. But I've created that situation where he knows he can talk to me about those things. And that goes back to that relationship thing and that long-term thing. We need to give guys safe spaces to make sure that they can feel that they can engage and be heard. You know, all that stoicism, there's a place for stoicism, don't get me wrong, I truly believe that. But actually, at the same time, there's an even bigger space for vulnerability needed.
Yeah.
Isn't stoicism a response to not feeling able to change a situation? And that coming to accept a situation through stoicism?
where do you want to go with this conversation?
I think, I think that we could get kind of go off on some massive sidetracks, but there is something about kind of accepting the situation you're in, and there is certainly an element of stoicism which I think would say accept the situation you're in, live with the misery, understand the misery, and for some that's probably appealing, but actually I guess we might be at risk of getting caught up in saying, you know, let's not be stoic, because actually stoicism is really important in the way that we might make some decisions, but we need the skills to work out when to be stoic and when to be a little bit more kind of, oh crap, I do need to do something now, kind of thing, or, you know.
There was
it's dropping off.
Does it come down to that level of emotional intelligence then to navigate social situations?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's, again, something that men typically may not have. So we need to build that into society.
Yeah. And then without kind of making any really evidence-based statements, I wonder if there's a cohort effect of a group of men that we need to pay particular attention to. And I think this plays out in the suicide statistics that we see, that there's a cohort of men that until recently was kind of 45 to 50,
mm-hmm.
and that's now shifting to sort of 50 to 55, which kind of makes me think this is about a specific set of characteristics for people born in the 70s, where actually our younger generation, you know, they're facing a different set of challenges and issues and a world that appears to be falling apart around them. And actually, we'll need to think differently about that group. And I guess it just sort of reflected that I think we've probably been talking about, you know, men that are 40 or 50.
Possibly, yeah.
That are that are beginning to experience health issues that they still don't deal with, which is why they all die far too young from their heart disease kind of thing. But there, I think, for each kind of generation or age group, there might be different things that researchers need to think about. How do I actually engage effectively with this group?
I think that's a really good point. I think, we've been very global, haven't we, in our kind of expectation of what researchers will do. and the ask is probably a little bit too much. But if you begin to, you know, target's the wrong word, but if you begin to look at when you're approached with a research question and it's around men's health and it's around men between the ages of 18 and 20, what is it in terms of your research design that you can pick up from the things that we've been talking about that would be as useful to you? And I think the word that we're saying is engagement.
Yeah. So the public, so in research, there's obviously this massive thing of, and really vital of public engagement, but actually it sort of makes me think that sometimes you need to treat men as a special group. I mean, men are a special group and very privileged and so on, as we've been talking about. But actually, I think more seriously, you need to treat men as a special group because they have their own peculiar set of behaviours and mannerisms. And
even
tradition.
The term special comes with its own unique set of challenges, because whether it's positive or negative connotations that you're using.
Exactly. But, you know, it's right that we engage with how do we support more people from kind of different ethnicities to take part in research.
Mm-hmm.
Really important because of the kind of cultural barriers that are in place. But we don't think about that for men. And actually, maybe what we're arguing is that perhaps researchers do need to think about every group that they want represented in their research and work out, do I need a different strategy for black people as I might for men that are age 30 to kind of 45 and for teenagers? And then over here, I need to do something different for the women that we want represented in this. And it's not just women en masse, it's, you know, young women, older women, menopausal women, all these different kind of, you know, it's easy to think.
The great intersectional dilemma of oppression and
everyone
can be split in different ways.
Yeah, but I think our researchers need to think quite carefully about how do we get the best representation in our research and not just ignore kind of en masse whole groups of people.
That's a lovely ending.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you, chaps.